From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on a soccer field. It's a story told by our City News colleague Tim Macaluso, who profiled Jerome Underwood, the president and CEO of Action for a Better Community. Macaluso writes that Underwood had come to the United States from his native Antigua, and his outstanding grades earned him a place at St. John Fisher College. Underwood was also a passionate soccer player, and a very good one. And he had been warned that the United States was a place where racism was common, but he perhaps hadn't expected to encounter it so quickly. On that soccer field, an opposing player called him a racial epithet that we can't repeat here. Underwood tells City News that it filled him with rage, hearing that word on what is, for him, a sacred place, the soccer pitch. It was a sad learning experience and serves as a reminder that there is still so much progress to make in this country. Underwood built an impressive career, first for Marine Midland Bank, where he took the comparatively rare step of seeking out business owners from all racial backgrounds. His career had multiple stops after that, and Underwood became indispensable for the Rochester City School District, where he managed large operations. He coached soccer for hundreds of kids, and he built relationships with multiple organizations, including work for the board at ABC, Action for a Better Community. And he has taken the lead job, finishing up his first year at Action for a Better Community, which exists, he says, to eliminate or reduce poverty. Not a simple task, to state the obvious. ABC employs nearly 400 people, oversees 6 Head Start centers, and there's a broad range of programs and initiatives that ABC is involved with. This hour, we've asked Jerome Underwood to sit down with us to discuss his views of the problems and possible path to solutions facing our community. Jerome Underwood, President and CEO of Action for a Better Community. Wonderful to have you here. Thank you for taking the time.
Good afternoon, Evan. Good afternoon, Rochester.
And this is ending your first year coming up here. We're about to celebrate year one.
You know, today is February 1st. And I think it's fitting that I'm here on the first day of Black History Month. And actually, today ends my first year as President and CEO of Action for a Better Community.
And so, congratulations with that, but there is still so much, and I know you're sort of the type of person to say, you know, congratulations is a strange word when we're all trying to deal with poverty, and it can feel so intractable. Let me just sort of back up a little bit to your childhood, and I thought Tim and City News did a really nice job helping us see the picture of where your life has taken you. You grew up as one of 8 siblings, is that right?
That's correct, and let me say this. I'm going to make you an informed Antiguan.
Okay.
Most people hear it all the time,
but I hate making that mistake. Antigua.
Antigua. The U is silent. Yeah. So for, you know, I don't know if anybody from Antigua is listening, but it's Antigua.
Antigua.
Right? Antigua.
So you're 1 of 8.
That's right.
What was life like growing up? What do you remember most?
I remember spending a lot of time on a soccer field. Our neighborhood, like many neighborhoods at home, you created your neighborhood, and, you know, I have 5 brothers and 2 sisters. You know, one of my brothers is deceased, but I have a lot of friends as well who we played a lot. And academically, our parents did not play when it came to taking academics seriously. My grandmother, who is the most amazing human being that I ever met, went to school one day in her life, but she was bent, and she had one child, which was our mother. I never knew my father's parents because he didn't knew them either, because they passed when he was a child. And so my grandmother was the only grandparent that we had. And Granny, as we affectionately called her, basically said to us, take education seriously. It will be your rocket ship to an easier life. And that quote-unquote uneducated woman was one of the most brilliant people I've ever met, and all of us took that to heart. Not only me, but most people that I knew took that to heart, not just our family. Education is taken very, very seriously, and it has helped me tremendously to sit in this chair that I'm sitting in right now.
One of the things that various organizations have tried to do in recent years here in Rochester, they hold what they call poverty simulations. They try to help people understand the choices that people living in poverty have to make, the challenge, the struggle. And I think it's an admirable goal. I think as someone who's never experienced it myself, I would never sort of try to deign to speak of what life was like. How much do you think your experience growing up does inform you to really understand that what struggle is, the choices people have to make, and related issues?
Personally, I'm not a fan of the simulations because it re-traumatizes me. Mm. However, I understand their need and their value. You know, I'm sure you've heard many, many people say, you know, we didn't even know we were poor because we didn't lack for love, you know. And this whole concept of village is something that I grew up experiencing. And what it did for all of us was teach us how to be resilient and to survive on what you had. And you'll hear me talk about my grandmother again. She always said, don't put your head where your body can't pass. And a lot of Caribbean people, I'm sure, familiar with that. And it's a colloquialism. I'm sure it's applicable in a lot of cultures. But it was just to make do with what you had and to sacrifice and to sacrifice. And I teach that to now our adult children, of which my wife and I have three. It's just to sacrifice, but at the same time, strive for better and more all the time without sort of the more being sort of material, but for more knowledge and for more love and for treating people as you would have yourself be treated. And that's what wealth is, you know, just being able to have really good, strong relationships with people.
Your grandmother instilled that need and that desire for education. When you weren't working on studying, you spent a lot of time playing soccer, huh?
Yes. Yes. Oh, I was really good. and my children, if they're listening right now, like, Dad, those days are over.
But, no, I say they don't have to be.
Yes, they are. Yes. I had a good run. And literally, Evan, it was my ticket, so to speak. That's how I got to the United States of America. The very first time I put foot on the United States of America was to play in the Junior World Championships in 1980. I was the goalie for my country. I mean, that's my sort of claim to legitimacy, being able to represent the flag, so to speak. And it was 4 years after that I ended up coming for a tryout at St. John Fisher College. And, you know, as the story goes real quickly, because I know we got much more important things
sure.
to get into, a gentleman by the name of Mike Savitas, who still lives in Rochester today, he was the coach at the time. There's a little error in the article. But the tryout went well. And I thought I was going to get a soccer scholarship. And Mike Savitas broke my heart. You know, he said, well, we can't give soccer scholarships. We're a third division school. I didn't know anything about NCAA rules.
Sure.
And I said, what do you mean? You know, he said, well, we can't give financial incentives to athletes. And then something inside of me died as I turned to walk away. And about 2 seconds later, he asked that question. How are your grades? Well, I said, my grades are better than my soccer. So the way I tell young people when I, you know, tell the story is soccer was a crack in the window, but academics kicked the door in. And my tuition was paid for 4 years. And that enabled me to get my first degree.
I want to mentally flag this for a separate day. And I think you would be a great panelist for a discussion that I've been meaning to have about soccer culture in this country. There's a lot of criticism when you talk to parents whose kids like to play soccer, but parents feel this pressure that, well, we got to be in three different travel leagues, and it becomes a wealthy family sport. It becomes exclusive. You've got to be able on a Saturday to take your kid to an 8 a.m. game, then a noon game, then a 4 p.m. game, often an hour apart. And then we all look around and go, well, the United States doesn't have a lot of creative soccer players. We're not very good internationally. I wonder if there's a link. Do you feel it's become too exclusive in this country?
As you said, we have to table that. It's a two-day conversation.
It really is.
There's an unequivocal link. But I say to them, you know, follow the U.S. women's team. That the men need to follow the women. The women are phenomenal and, you know, ranked number one in the world. So I think the men's team can learn some things from the women's team.
All right, so that's a separate conversation. Come back, please, if you could. Jerome Underwood, the president and CEO of Action for a Better Community. And I think it's important that we lay some groundwork for listeners who have heard of the organization but maybe not directly experienced. What's the short description of now how you view the mission? Obviously, poverty is at the core of it, but how you're going about that and what ABC is doing right now.
I think it's important to point out that we, ABC, are part of a national network. You know, just real quickly again, the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964 is what gave birth to community action agencies. And we have a national network called the National Community Action Partnership. We are one of 1,000 ABCs across the country. And pretty much we are the community action agency responsible for reducing poverty in Monroe County and also Ontario County. You know, we do work. We have partners in Ontario County who do some of the lifting for us because they're there physically. And most of our work is concentrated in Monroe County, more specifically the city of Rochester. Clearly, this is a formidable task, this work, this most honorable work to fight poverty. And it's not for the faint of heart. And many could argue, and argue, I think, effectively, that so far we're losing the battle. The war rages on because it takes a certain amount of conviction, if you will, in your chest to step up to this fight. It's extremely complex and multifaceted in how we need to approach it. And those areas create difficult but necessary conversations, which I know we're going to talk a little bit about today.
Well, and you've said many times that there is not one silver bullet. There's not one thing that has to change. But is there a single piece of this that is the most frustrating or intractable, whether it's systemic racism, a lack of understanding of what has led to this sort of entrenched poverty? Is there something that you feel like is a pillar that until that falls, we're not going to solve this?
I don't think it's one pillar, but not frustrating. I mean, things are frustrating, but I try not to get frustrated, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
I think most things, leadership is key. And, you know, if you don't mind, it doesn't matter. You know, but if it's a priority for you, and, you know, as some of my colleagues who I know they're listening now, we have to find a way to make the important urgent. Now, important and urgent are very, very, very different. You have to make this a priority because when we look at recent poverty data, you know, I think since recent data, ACT Rochester released its most recent information back in December with a press release that as far as Rochester is concerned, we're not trending in the right direction. You know, we've moved up on that dubious chart, so to speak. But leadership matters. And not just, you know, the ideological framework that a leader brings to his or her work is where I think sort of it starts. And as you mentioned, not the only necessary thing, but if a leader pick an organization, pick an entity, finds it important to work on things that are going to affect poverty, such as justice, you know, what are the virtues that a leader brings to his or her job? And those things, you don't change your persona. I'm a firm believer you don't change your persona from who you are when you go to work. And if these are the things that you feel really, really passionate about, it takes passion to do this work. It's not glamorous work. It's not sexy work, so to speak. We have a tough time getting funding for the work, even though they're very generous funders out there. But when we talk about when we look at the data in terms of what are the things that uphold poverty, it requires challenges to literally the power structures. And that's where, you know, people tend to sort of recoil and go back to their corners. And what myself and others try to say to folks, stay in the room for the conversation beyond the emotion that it's going to evoke. Because, yes, it's an emotional discussion, but we have to get beyond emotion to get to, okay, what are we now going to do with what we know to be fact?
Has enough time passed with the Anti-Poverty Initiative for you to feel, I mean, nothing is perfect, but for you to feel that it has made some admirable strides, or do you feel that some serious change is needed with it?
No, enough time hasn't passed. We're at, I think, 3 years and a couple of months in, so I'm getting much more involved with that, and as a matter of fact, ABC, you know, we are, as far as it's probably arguable that we're the preeminent anti-poverty agency in Rochester. That's what we espouse to be, and one of the things that we intend to do, because I understand in very clear terms what RMAP-P is intended to do, and I think one of the misunderstandings is that RMAP-P is going to somehow do something and poverty is going to, they're not a service organization. We are. You know, so I'm now part of the steering committee, and what I intend to do as president and CEO of ABC, is bring what we're doing to the table. In other words, data in terms of how we counteract poverty, like the way I've said it, like I said, eliminate or reduce poverty. You know, what are we doing? We have to find a way to, we being ABC, be more, how should I put it, vocal with the poverty reduction outcomes that we're having, not just the activities, but the outcomes, as an example, to be specific. And I've told Dr. Brock this, you know, we intend to lead out in the path to self-sufficiency. For instance, we have a number of, we fight poverty in a bunch of different ways. Not, you know, I prefer to talk about them in the verticals such as housing and education and employment, as opposed to the programs we have that sort of work on those things.
Sure.
But I intend to, when we go to these meetings, say, well, you know, last month, you know, we created 32 jobs or in the healthcare field through our HPOG project, Health Professionals Opportunity Grant, where we're teaching people and getting them ready for jobs in the fast-growing field of healthcare, such as phlebotomy and nursing, EMTs, that type of thing, or the work we're doing with YAMTEP, the collaborative work we're doing with them to get people trained to retain jobs. Getting a job is one thing, but keeping it is another thing. So we want to make sure we're putting people in jobs that are upwardly mobile and that have living wages as opposed to minimum wage. So the anti-poverty program, RMAPI, when anybody who knows about poverty looks at what does it take to really make the kind of change, it's going to take 7 to 10 years. Now, at the same time, that's not to scare people, because there are people, we want to see some results right now. We've heard that there's big money being spent, etc. The biggest thing, in my opinion, that we have to change is people's mentality around this, because we are very, very aware that a lot of the challenges that people who are needy, as opposed to poor, have are social-emotional challenges that prevents them from doing what I call getting up to the starting line or getting up to the batter's block. Those things, which are historical trauma, present trauma, those things are hard to fund in terms of dollars and resources to make sure that, you know, if Jerome goes to work and somebody happens to say something to trigger his trauma, that he doesn't go off, you know, and all of a sudden he's now out of a job. So there's people in the mental health field that are working on things like that just to get people ready to go to work. So, again, this is painstaking work that we have to take our time with. But I think from an RMAPI point of view, and hopefully in the embodiment of me speaking here, to sort of change the understanding or the expectation, it's agencies like ours, ABC and others, who are in this work, because we're not the only ones, obviously. But we, the collective impact that we can have, because if ABC added 10 jobs this week and Ibero added 4, making sure that, you know, they're different, it's not the same individual, and the Urban League, et cetera, Catholic Family, all the folks who are working on doing anti-poverty work, we have to collaborate and bring our resources to bear. Hopefully, you know, we can do that in a collaborative fashion and start attacking poverty rather than waiting for our MAPI itself to do that.
I want to talk a little bit about trauma, because this is something that I know that Tim's piece in City touched on. And I think it's important, because when you talk about someone who may get a job, mm-hmm. but then something is said or something happens in a work setting that triggers trauma, and there might be an outburst, that person could lose a job.
Yes.
And I certainly don't want to speak for you. It seems to me that you are in the camp that says you've seen enough to say we need to look at trauma as something that is inherited, that can be inherited, that can be passed down, that can be literally part of our DNA.
There's no question. The field of epigenetics, which I am no expert on, clearly delineates that. It's science. And I'm a student of Dr. Joy DeGruy's work, and she outlines it. But many other social scientists, as I call them, have proven that epigenetics is a thing whereby, having not experienced trauma yourself, the effects of it can be easily seen in one's behavior. It's been proven and tested. It's not even debatable anymore, whereby trauma can change people's DNA. The good thing about it is that it's reversible. There are resilient factors that can be brought to bear to change that. And as someone who has experienced trauma before in multiple ways, it's just that pause, that realize that here's a trigger for me. You know, and we know that, okay, if that trigger goes and the bullet is in the chamber, it's too late. So we have to find a way, even for young people, very young children, we can do this with them. Because, for instance, and not trying to get too technical, because Jerome is not a technical, I'm not a mental health professional, but I'm aware now of the impact of cortisone, right? Cortisol, I'm sorry, and how that triggers freeze or fright or flight situations. I've seen it in a classroom where at the district, you might have a third, fourth grader, and he or she is just going to run around the classroom, you know. And, you know, heretofore, people like me would say, well, what's wrong with you, Evan? As opposed to, what happened to him? You know, what happened to the child? Did something just trigger his cortisol? Because, you see, when cortisol is released in the brain, it shuts off higher brain functioning. For adults, as well as children, you cannot access reason. Now, this is real science. So the thing is, if we know that about a child or an individual, our response to that child who's going to be a runner or somebody's just going to sit in a catatonic stage, the response would be different. Rather than punitive, we have to find out, okay, so how do we deal with that behavior? First of all, if we can figure out by developing deep, deep relationships, what are the triggers, then we try to avoid the triggers as opposed to respond with a punitive behavior.
And on the lines of punitive versus maybe some other remedies, I want to talk about some of the work of making sure kids in Rochester are there, they're in the classroom, that we're working sort of constructively with the challenges they face. And as you know, superintendents in the past have worked on issues like truancy. In fact, mm-hmm. I think you've been closely involved with some of that work, yes?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I prefer to use the terminology of chronic absence as opposed to truancy.
Okay.
Because truancy suggests an intent, you know? If my mother's listening, which I'm sure she's not, I mean, I skipped school a couple of times as a teenager, but I did that on my own. With my history of working at the district. And now, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, we, Action for Better Community, we have 6 Head Start centers, and we have about 1,100 3- and 4-year-olds. And we're keenly looking at attendance in school. And we know 3- or 4-year-olds are not making a decision to not go to school. The decisions and the challenges of attendance are largely adult challenges. And the barriers or the challenges or the things that adults have to encounter. And as you know, in order to be a Head Start family, you have to be poor. Our customers are poor because it's income eligibility. So if children are not coming to Head Start, there are adult reasons for that. So what we have to try to do is figure out what are the impediments to bringing that child to school and try to close those gaps, whether it's trauma, you know, we're getting evicted next week, or I'm depressed, you know, for pick a reason. And those are the things that, you know, somehow enter paralysis into a person's mode of operation.
Sure.
So that they don't get the little child on the bus when they're supposed to.
And so when you were skipping school, you were truant.
Yes, because okay. It was the individual's intent.
It was
yes.
A choice. It was an intent versus
right.
Chronic absence,
yes.
Which has a lot of other complex factors.
Yes.
The reason I ask is there's more national conversation in the last week about this than I've seen in a long time, because one of the early entrants in the presidential field, Senator Kamala Harris, made some remarks when she was the DA in California, or the Attorney General, the AG mm-hmm. in California, in which she boasted of her own record, saying, hey, if kids aren't going to school, we eventually we will put the parents in jail. that there will be punitive measures to incarcerate parents if their kids do not get to school. Now she's walking, she seems to walk a little bit about that back, and I think there, some of her critics have said that is really punitive and ignores a lot of the complex issues there. I don't mean to overly shorten this, listeners, and I promise we'll talk about it more in depth in its own conversation, because I don't want to be unfair to Senator Harris. But in that punitive measure, what would you say to somebody who said, if you were still working on chronic absence, hey, if parents can't get their kids to school, put them in jail? What do you say to that?
No, I totally reject that approach, because it's, you know, it's the carrot or the stick. You know, it's honey versus vinegar. What I've learned over the past 6 years in my experience in terms of dealing directly with the major challenge of chronic absence is to first seek to understand and then to be understood. In other words, what are the antecedents to this chronic absence? What are the reasons? And the reasons could be as varied as the number of families. But of course, there's some commonality. So in terms of the causation, that's one. Secondly, it's to impress on the parents because of the importance of what Granny told us. You know, we're trying to, it's a means to an end, a solid education. Because if the child is not in the seat, then teachers don't get to do what they so can wonderfully do. So rather than punitive, I prefer building than breaking, you know, and building these bridges as opposed to walls, let me just get that in, you know, to try to create a relationship between the families that like what we're doing in Head Start, to make the families understand that particularly early childhood education is that rocket ship to the predictability of what's going to happen to your entire life if you don't get a solid education is as plain as a clean glass of water to see through. So I don't espouse the punitive approach at all. Now, at the same time, did we find or do we see that there's a small segment of the population of parents that, come on, man, just get up off of you know what and do it. But no, we find that to be less than 10%.
Interesting.
Yes.
But there's probably a stereotype, particularly among, you know, sort of affluent suburbanites, oh, yes, often white people, yeah, who may look at the city and say, that's lazy.
Absolutely. You know, that's, and we have to change that narrative. And, you know, again, thank you for the opportunity to talk about that, because that's, it's not valid. You know, it's incorrect. You know, and it's that walking the mile in the shoes, you know, because everybody has stress, but stress is relative. You know, someone's stress may be, well, I wonder what I'm going to drive to work today, the Audi or the BMW. Somebody else's stress may be, how do I get to work today? Because, you know, I just don't have a car, it's cold outside, and, you know, the past 2 days at school have been closed, you know, but, you know, even at 20 degrees, if you have a child in a stroller and you also have an 8-year-old, and how do you do that? You know, so these challenges, they're not easy, simple, linear things to deal with. But we have to develop the type of relationships with these families. And see, this is where it gets sort of sticky now, because you have to actually get close. Because as we know, in this poverty work, the solution is as closer to the problem as possible. So we have to find a way to get as close as possible and develop the kind of deep, lasting relationships so that people can be really honest with us and us with them, you know, so that we can remove the barriers. Because I've met very, very few parents, and I've met thousands, who don't value education for their children. But it's these impediments that are in front of them, and that, you know, we've learned about learned helplessness, because we see what happened to Uncle Tony, and he tried hard and he had 2 degrees and he got smashed. And when I say smashed, I mean just he got, you know, to a certain point and he just couldn't progress anymore. Why do I want to try that? Why do I want to put myself in a situation where we know that, you know, racism is going to impact me, and, you know, I have the kind of temperament, well, I'll just hit somebody. No, we're trying to talk young people down off of those fences to say, no, there's another way. But at the same time, again, multi-pronged, we have to deal with the establishments to say, well, you can't condone that kind of behavior in your establishment, you know, because it's threatening and offensive to other people. And if we're trying to really, as Rodney King say, all get along, there's some things that people really need to understand that heretofore they haven't spent any time investing in terms of knowledge. And I'm talking about cultural competence, you know, to, you know, we are living in a diverse society. It's not changing, it has changed, ED. So how do we really get along with each other? And that requires some investment of all of us into each other's. And, you know, having really deep conversation that some call appreciative inquiry to really find out what's, you know, what are the things that motivate Evan, and how does, you know, your ideological framework match up or not to mine if we have a common objective? Because this thing, poverty, if people, again, back to if you don't mind, you don't matter, if people think that poverty is something that we should attack, well, there's some antecedents to it. There's some causation factors that we need to get to. Some of that is debatable, but that's where the facts and the data come in. And I always direct folks to the ACT Rochester website, which is a phenomenal resource of information, because when you look at poverty data there, or you look at employment data, or you look at housing data, you look at education data, all of them, every single one, healthcare, they're slanted along racial lines. We have to deal with it.
What's the website?
ACTRochester.org.
A lot of information there.
A lot of information.
Way late for our early break. Janice writes to the program and says, Evan, your guest is a treasure to this community. When is he going to run for office? I didn't think you'd expect that question, Jerome.
Which office? Office?
I don't know.
My house?
Ask Janice. Janice, he wants to know which office. But that's very kind. Janice sees you. I think this is a big leadership position on its own. I think it sounds like Jerome Underwood, who is the president and CEO of Action for a Better Community, is busy enough.
Indeed. We have a lot of work to do. You know, we have a lot going on at ABC. We're really pleased, and some of the public may know, and this may be new for others. We just, about 4 or 5 months ago, we sold our building at 49 Stone Street and have relocated the offices of Head Start and our youth and community development to 400 West Avenue, which is right next to Tops. We have leasing space on that old ACC building, so we're leasing the third floor there. Last month, we sold our corporate headquarters at 550 East Main, and the administrative offices will be moving over to join our colleagues at 400 West Avenue in about another 60 days. So by the end of March, we're going to have about 115 people located at 400 West Avenue. So that's going to do a couple of things for the agency. It's going to put us all together, not the entire agency, but about 115 of our 400 employees on one floor. So that's going to help bring down some of the silos and make us more effective in doing what we do. It's better for our employees that don't have to pay for parking at the Stone Street Garage. We were subsidizing some of that, but now it is a large parking lot. It's actually also better for our customers because we're now in the neighborhood. Our grassroots are in the civil rights fight, so to speak. And I want to just big up, if I can, you know, I can't come here today and not talk about the shoulders that I stand on, and it's Black History Month, and we just laid to rest about a month and a half ago, Constance Mitchell, around whose kitchen table ABC was born. So I want to just once again offer up to Connie Mitchell my condolences, and just the condolences to the entire community for Constance Mitchell and her passing. She was an absolute icon in this community, and along with her and Dr. Walter Cooper and Minister Franklin Florence Sr., those are the people who gave birth to ABC, and I'm grateful for their work.
Let's get our early break. We'll get more of your feedback. I see our phone ringing. If you want to call the program, you can do that. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. And when Jerome Underwood talks about the fact that, unfortunately, race is interwoven with so many of the statistics we see, the trend lines we see, and we have to be honest about that, he talks about getting close, very close to the people who are dealing with poverty. But also, when we come back, we want to talk about maybe what he'd like to see from the community of people who could be allies in this effort, what it means to be non-racist versus anti-racist, and all of the ways that the complexities and the ways that that could impact the situation in Rochester. So let's get that break, more of your feedback, and much more ahead with Jerome Underwood from ABC next. Coming up in our second hour, we talk to Dr. Irma McLaurin, who is the featured speaker at the annual luncheon for the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. McLaurin is going to talk about what divides us and what unites us, our commonalities, what makes us different, but what should make us proud of our common humanity. That is next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Bill on the line first. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, I want to say, Jerome, congratulations. There is no better person to be in this position, because Jerome not only asks the hard questions, but he waits and looks for the right answer. That kind of intelligence cannot be underestimated. So I want to say a big thank you to Jerome for taking over the responsibility of this position. With you at the head, we know we're going in the right way. That's all. That's what I wanted to say to you, Jerome. Thank you.
Bill, thank you.
I appreciate that, Bill. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I know you've heard a lot of sentiment like that. What does that mean to you?
It's extremely humbling, and it strengthens my resolve, actually, because the bar has really raised high. But I have a lot of people that mentor me, and some of them are much younger than I am. You know, I really, really enjoy talking to young people, because talk about another Bill. I was really fortunate to be in the very, very first class of the African-American Leadership Development Program way back in 1992. And when we graduated from that class, a gentleman by the name of William Johnson, who was the then president of the Urban League, he was our keynote speaker. And he said something then that stayed with me, and I'm going to repeat now. And he said, youth are about 50% of the population, but they're 100% of the future. Anything that you do should take into consideration the impact to them, and they should be involved. So that has stayed with me, and I've always made sure that I've had young people as part of my sort of advisory group. So I appreciate the call and the sentiments, Bill, and we have a lot of work to do, and I have an amazing staff of people at ABC, many who have been with the agency for 20-plus years, and they're really, really committed and are teaching me a lot about the nuances of the agency. A good portion of my work is outside the agency, talking to other leaders in the community about, you know, what you led into the break on, in terms of how do we collaboratively deal with the difficult things that allow Rochester to be third on, of the poorest cities of the largest 75 cities in the country. The antecedents to those challenges. Again, we cannot deny the impact of race on that. And this is the conversation, as I mentioned earlier, that we try to have people stay in the room, again, mentally on, to get past the emotional side to figure out, okay, so what do we do? Because when we look at the data, in the education field, in the poverty field, in the economic field, using evidence-based practices is said over and over again. So when we dig into that, so what does that really, really mean? When we look at median household income in Monroe County and see that the median household income for people of color, largely Latino people and people of African descent, is half of that of our Caucasian brothers and sisters, we have to figure, okay, why? When we look at median household income in the city of Rochester, it's about 60% of that. When we look at unemployment and the unemployment rates for people of African descent, two and a half times that of all Caucasian brothers and sisters. We have to dig into the why. We have to, in my opinion, the people who lead things and places and look at their own institutions, love to look inwardly. And, you know, before I even started talking about this publicly, I started to look at ABC. Well, what do we look like? Do we resemble a community that we serve? Looks is one thing. And then, but what is our ideological perspective? I'm really, really proud that our staff at Action for a Better Community almost mimics the people that we serve to a percentage point. You know, we have a little gap, you know, about 2 to 3 percentage points, but it's almost the same. Over and above that, we take very, very seriously that whole necessity to be culturally competent and thus responsive. When we look at other organizations in Rochester, and I encourage every organization who's listening to you right now, whether now or if they're listening, you know, on demand later on, to look at your own organization and say, well, for the people that I serve, what gives me the credibility to serve them, either by knowledge, experience, or just the people who we have? In other words, how do I know how to help people who are needy into what they need to do? What's our skill and experience in that? You know, is it because, well, you know, I'm president of CEO of ABC? No, it helps having walked that path, either by experience or by education, hopefully both. So you mentioned being a non-racist or being an anti-racist. Now, what is that? I should ask you the question.
So, all right, so I'm actually going to go back to that sort of soccer field incident, and I'm just going to offer a small example. If I'm on the soccer field and I hear someone use a racial epithet, use what we would call the N-word.
Yes.
I could say nothing, and I could say, oh, I would never use that word. As a non-racist, I would never use that word. Or as a perceived non-racist, that's a whole other show, right? About, right? Or as an anti-racist, I could step in and get in the face of someone and stand up immediately and intervene. If I'm in the community, I could say, look, I would hire anybody who comes in. But as an anti-racist, I could say, if I'm not reflecting, if our organization doesn't reflect the community, we have to be intentional.
Yeah.
We have to work harder than just saying, we're open to anybody who shows up.
Yeah.
Well, what are you doing to get them to show up? That's, at least that's the starting point, and I have a very rudimentary understanding of this.
Oh, it's you're on point, though. Let me lift it up a little higher. If I chair the board of an organization who is working in the community and we're looking to hire a chief executive, am I going to make one of the requirements for the chief executive that he or she have the cultural competence to hold a job? And secondly, as the chief executive, how are you going to run the organization? You know, are the people that you're going to hire, Mr. CEO or Ms. CEO, going to reflect the community? Not just the fact that reflect them, because again, you know, hopefully people realize that we're not talking about just hire a person of color just because they're a person of color. I mean, hopefully we're way beyond that and we realize that they're extremely competent people. But are we going to put that as a measure of an evaluative measure? In other words, am I going to be held accountable for that, if you think that matters, as I'm being held accountable for the bottom line of the agency? What's important to the leadership, again, at the board level, at the CEO level, at the executive level, at the staff level? So when we're talking about being an anti-racist in terms of, if you see something, you have to say something. Not only say, but you have to do. In other words, we don't condone that behavior anywhere in this organization, in this society, in this school, period. Because, you know, as I've heard, you know, an object in one direction can only stop if it has an object coming in the other direction. You know, just ignoring it is not enough. And, you know, as we say, pulling the shades. You know, if you pull the shades down, what is going on outside is still going on. So we have to be very, very deliberate in a non-threatening kind of way. And this is the part, because not because we have to, because for some people, there's no issue. Things are fine. But for people doing this job, and, you know, I know there's a lot of, you know, people of European descent who absolutely abhor racism. I know that for a fact. I've talked to many of them. The action that is required from them and the actions that they feel to, because there's only two ways, as far as I'm concerned, for oppression to stop. One, the oppressor picks up his or her foot off the oppressee's neck. Or two, there's a revolution. Hopefully, if there's a revolution, there's an intellectual revolution, because Jerome, for sure, is not espousing any other kind of revolution, but an intellectual revolution. But let's hope that the oppressor picks up his or her foot, because in that way, that's the preferred way. And in order to do that, and in my experience, I've seen where allies, as we call them, have really jumped in and doing the work and get ostracized, you know, and they get called the end lover, or they, why are you lobbying so hard and pushing so hard for people of color? You know, what about us? You know, so the thing, it gets to be, again, this emotion in terms of, well, isn't that sort of redistribution of wealth? You know, so we get in, as opposed to, well, if we're talking about justice and things that have been done, and when we look at history, because again, history is not last week or last year or last century, how we got here has been systemically built, I mean, even by federal and state laws. So we, again, multi-systemic, again, we have to look at these things to say, are there unintentional outcomes toward otherwise good policies?
I think leadership of people like Jerome Underwood has pushed even ostensible allies, whether it's media, the business community, et cetera, to say, hey, for years I've operated in a way that I thought was non-racist. But now I understand what anti-racist means, and it's incumbent upon us to change that. I think that that change is at least happening, that the language is changing, that people are understanding that concept better, though I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Yeah.
But I think at least people are understanding it more. Do you?
Yeah, I do think, you know, I'm extremely optimistic. I'm extremely optimistic. You can't not be optimistic and do this work. And let me give you some, as young people say, some receipts for my optimism. I have many, many conversations with other leaders in this town, you know, and leaders who don't look like me, you know. And I feel a shift. Certainly it's not as fast and as dramatic as anybody would like to see it. But however, one of the big things, and I think this is a challenge for everybody, there is a nice change in leadership that's happening. And there are some African-American and Latino, young and not so young like myself, leaders who have been given the helm of certain institutions and organizations, and we're bringing a slightly different flavor. But now, the next frontier, if you will, is to really, really hand over the keys. And for people to really understand that, you know, these new and upcoming leaders actually can handle all of the responsibilities, particularly the financial management. In other words, just give us the resources and let us do what we need to do for our communities, those communities that we actually grew up in or are very, very familiar with. That, you know, there's still a little bit of sentiment that I wonder if they can really handle their own affairs. That exists. That's real. Even with allies. You know, so, but what we're, the conversations we're having is, well, why don't you give us a chance to prove ourselves? Mm-hmm. You know, just release. It's like your child. I mean, everybody's protective. You know, that can you really, you know, can we, do we want to give him the car to go out by himself, or do we want to drive him there? And, you know, no, just release that and have confidence, you know, in our experience, our training, and our intent to really make the kind of change that our community needs. Because heretofore, you know, when we look at what has to change, again, not leadership, just leadership, but there's an ideological framework that I think myself and some of the people that I know are bringing that is sort of revolutionary, you know, and very direct. But at the same time, the intent is to not be threatening, because we actually need everybody in this fight, because the challenges that we're facing, the economic, the educational challenge that we're facing, are really going to need all hands on deck.
Well, thanks a lot. I got through about a third of what I wanted to talk to with Jerome. So down to our last minute or so, and we're just going to have many conversations. I want to end on this note, because I know you're an optimist. Is it harder in the last couple of years? At your introductory news conference, you referenced at the time that with the president's remarks about what he called developing nations and the corrosive language he used.
Yeah.
You're from Antigua.
Yes.
And you understand the stereotyping and what the president's words, the harm they could do.
Yeah.
Has that challenged your optimism?
it has motivated me. It's like being 2-0 down in a soccer game. You know, it's halftime. Do you think you can win? Because if you don't think you can win, why are you going to take the field? Oh, we absolutely know. Not only believe, but know we can win. Are we going to have to work hard and make sure the defense is tighter? But, you know, things like that. And, you know, a lot of my friends are also people from the Caribbean and Africa. And as I said, we improve wherever we are because we're educated folks. You know, our ideological framework is that of just we need to improve wherever we are. And we try to make sure that we treat people fairly all the time. So I'm an extreme optimist. And I believe that together we can really improve Rochester, Monroe County, New York State, the world.
It's an honor to have you. Thank you. Let's come back and talk about a lot of different things.
Yeah, indeed.
Including soccer on some other occasion for the fun of it here. Jerome Underwood is the president and CEO of Action for a Better Community and one of the leaders in this community on these very difficult battles in front of us. So we appreciate his time, and I promise you, listeners, I just heard from Annette saying, sitting in my car, can't get out of my car, riveted to this conversation. Thank you, Annette. Well, there will be more with Jerome, and there's more connections straight ahead.